This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
All right, y'all, good morning. Thanks for waking up to come hang out with us. We're going to get started. Yay. Of all the panels, you chose ours. Aw, thanks, y'all. So just a quick reminder, you've probably heard this in the other panels, but please keep your mask on, unless you're taking a sip of water or something. And we want to make sure keeping everyone safe, because there is a surge in Chicago, if you haven't heard yet. But once again, want to thank y'all for coming. My name is Peyton. My pronouns are they, them. I am a part of the staff collective at Dissenters, and I'm based in Chicago, but I'm from Georgia. Yeehaw. So who in the world is Dissenters? Dissenters is a youth anti-militarist, anti-imperialist organization. We are a national organization, but we started here in Chicago. We have chapters across the country at universities and a few crews in some cities like New York and DC and right here in Chicago in the Bay Area. Has anyone heard of Dissenters? Yay! That means I'm doing my job. Okay, love that. So this summer we went on some international youth delegations to three countries. We went to Cuba, Guatemala, and the Philippines. Yeehaw. And these panelists, and Dissenters more broadly, we're currently organizing against the U.S. Empire because gross. but what does it actually mean when you live in like the belly of the beast? We live in the heart of an empire, right? When we talk about organizing for revolution, girl, it's gonna happen last year last, because they gonna fight to tooth, or they gonna it's gonna happen here last, because they gonna fight. Empire is meant to perpetuate itself. It's going to fight to survive. So our role specifically as Dissenters, it means that what we have is there's higher stakes. Inside our borders are the manufacturers of empire and imperialism. So to be young people, organizing against empire where there isn't really a movement of like black and brown young anti-war organizers, it means we have to leave the country. We need to leave the United States to actually see what it means to be organizing for socialism, organizing for revolution, organizing against imperialism and capitalism. So this morning we're going to get to hear from our lovely panelists who can take the time to introduce themselves. You want to go first, Ruby? Oh, I just spoiled it.
Oh, no, honey. Okay. Good morning, y'all. My name is Ruby. I'm part of Loyola University Chicago Dissenters, and I'm one of the people who was able to go to the Philippines on a 28-person delegation in order to do some fact-finding on the EDCA sites, which are basically U.S. military bases that are stationed all across the Philippines.
Hey, y'all. My name is Christian. I use he, him pronouns. I'm from Virginia. I'm temporarily Chicago-based, and I had the pleasure of going on a delegation to Cuba with the International People's Assembly to just learn about the impacts of a blockade and like how folks in Cuba are like dealing with that and dealing with the effects of U.S. imperialism.
Good morning, y'all. My name is Josue, pronouns he, they. I am also on the staff collective as a national field organizer, and I had the privilege of traveling to Guatemala, not for the first time since my family is from there, but this time to accompany victims of a regime in Guatemala that led to a genocide. And currently, one of the generals is on trial for genocide and acts against humanity.
And once again, my name is Peyton. I forgot to say I went with Christian Tacuba. And to get the energy going, because it's a little bit early in the morning. And I'm a morning person, so I apologize in advance if you're not. And this is, like, really annoying. But when we were in Cuba, we learned a chant that we would say to get, like, hype, right? So I'm going to teach y'all two. First one is high discipline.
High morale.
High discipline.
High morale.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. The second one is a little bit of a song. Okay. We already know it. It goes, because we know there's a blockade against Cuba. There's been a blockade against Cuba for over 6 years. So one of them is abajo, 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 el bloqueo, el mundo socialismo es el mundo que queremos. Abajo, 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 el bloqueo, el mundo socialismo es el mundo que queremos. Let's go! Okay. If you couldn't hear, that means lift the blockade. We're one a socialist world. Because period. We want both of those things. Okie dokie. We're going to get into the meat because we want to get a lot of times for y'all to ask questions. Each of us went to three countries that have suffered greatly under the hands of U.S. imperialism and militarism. And not just directly from the U.S., but U.S. hegemony used its influence in the global stage to influence other global, I don't want to say global powers, because what is it, the 40s? Other, like, countries who have a lot of global influence to also enforce imperialism against these countries as well, like the entire European Union. So my first question is for Christian, but we'll go, we want to go reverse clockwise. You here? I don't know why I started in the middle. Tell us about your delegation and some of the experiences you had that shed light on the effect of U.S. militarism there.
Okay, my delegation or whatever, we did like a variety of things. We were like just like looking at various aspects of public life and like how like society is organized in Cuba. So we like spent time with Las Roca Brigade, which is like a group of like construction workers. We went to the Latin American School of Medicine. We went with a group called Cenesex, who do like sexual education in Cuba. They were like a big driver behind the family code that Cuba passed a couple years ago. And then throughout all of these like different experiences, like one thing that was like very, very clear is that the U.S. blockade, U.S. imperialism, U.S. militarism is negatively impacting like practically every single aspect of public life in Cuba. We were also going to Cuba in a very like interesting period, one of the like worst financial crises in the country's history, like one of the worst crises since the revolution, and like one of the like largest like periods of time of people, young people especially, leaving Cuba because of the conditions. So like a very strange like time to be there. And also coming from the US, something that like struck me particularly is that like at the center is like one of our like big slogans is like divest from death, invest in life. And I feel like what we were witnessing in Cuba was like an interesting like mirror, interesting foil to the way we see the struggle manifest like within the United States. And like a key thing to me was like the question of healthcare, like for example, because like in like US I think is a society that's very much oriented around death and like death making. And societies in Cuba felt, I got the impression, was like structured very differently. Like we want people to have food, we want people to have education, and we want people to have healthcare. This was very much something that we saw. Like one of our like fellow people on the brigade like twisted her ankle or whatever and got to experience like the free healthcare in Cuba firsthand, which was like kind of funny. Like sorry for her ankle, but it was a little bit funny. Yeah, it was like Cuba is like one of the like major like exporters of like healthcare. Like they send like contingents of doctors throughout the country. When we went to the Latin American School of Medicine, we saw people like from like every continent like represented. People from Palestine, people from South Africa, and like other countries throughout the world. And something that struck me particularly is that the effects of a blockade on healthcare, like lack of access to very basic things. Like Cuba was like one of the first countries to produce a vaccine, but they couldn't get the needles or syringes that they needed to actually administer the vaccine. They were prevented from like sending the vaccine to particular countries because of the effects of a blockade. So this is very much something that's not, this isn't just like impacting Cuba. This isn't just warfare on Cuba. This is warfare on the world. And then also like we went to the Cuban like biotechnology institute. We're working on various like vaccines and like various like treatments for things. We're working on treatment for diabetic ulcers. So like people in Cuba, like they're not getting like amputated because of diabetes because they have treatments for that. We're working on treatments for lung cancer. We're working on treatments for a variety of things that would benefit the entire world and are prevented from doing so because of the blockade. So I think an interesting thing for me, like just being there, was being able to see like not the, just the impact of like what's happening to the people there, but like how that also reflects the US's orientation to the rest of the world and the prioritization of profit of attempting to defeat the socialist project at the expense of the livelihood, the conditions of life for people throughout the global south, people within the US as well.
Okay, so the delegation trip that I went to, it was organized by BAYAN, which is Bagyong Alansiang Makabayan, which is an alliance of anti-imperialist and progressive Filipino orgs, and BAYAN USA is their first overseas chapter as it's based in the Philippines. And on our two-week trip, we were able to integrate with both urban poor communities, peasant communities, and just different sectors, because the movement over there is very sectoral based and coming together as once. Just some context for the time that we went there. We were there in May, and May was around the end of the Balikatan joint military exercises between the U.S. and the Philippines, as well as the 25th anniversary of the visiting forcing agreements in the Philippines, which, if you don't know, it's an agreement that's unfair to the Philippines, where U.S. troops are allowed to rotate across the country for long periods of times. It's a loophole that they use, so they have multiple bases that they promise to give the Philippines once they're done occupying them. But in reality, they've been there for 25 years and longer. It was also the beginning of the jeepney phase-out, which, if you don't know what jeepneys are, it's a mode of public transportation made out of former jeeps that were left by U.S. troops during World War II. And they're phasing them out using greenwashing, saying that they're bad for the environment and they're taking away the livelihoods of the people who are living in the Philippines. And it was also the 7th anniversary of the Marawi siege, which was a U.S.-backed siege in the Philippines in the most southern region, where they basically claimed that there was terrorists living there. Marawi is a region that's actually a Muslim population. It's not a Catholic population living there. And in their operations over a period of 2 months, they blocked people from coming in and out of the city. And they used their weapons to basically carpet bomb the whole city. So we actually went there and we witnessed firsthand the impacts it's had on people 7 years after. Most of the people who their houses were in the cities have not been allowed to come back after 7 years. Their houses are still torn down. A lot of people, as an act of resistance, will go into the city and spray paint their name and phone number to know that their names will never be lost and that their land is not going to be lost. But 7 years after, in those evacuation centers, which are not provided by the government, the folks have to pay for basic utilities, access to medical care, but most of them don't have any form of actually making money because everything was taken away from them. So this was something that was backed by both U.S. weapons, intelligence, informing the armed forces of the Philippines, yet they take no responsibility over it even 7 years after. And just seeing the impacts it has on the people, but also the younger generations, being from Marawi is something that they're told to not be proud of, and a lot of discrimination actually happens because of that, and people can't get jobs. Or they're telling us that their kids, even when they go to school, they get bullied for not having school supplies or just access to basic things. And to see those struggles also interconnected with the people who are living in Cebu and are being impacted by the military bases. The military bases are something that the locations are hidden because the U.S. has no obligation to tell the Philippines what they're putting in there. So a lot of people have lots of worries around, are there nuclear weapons? What types of weapons are they doing? And people are basically waiting, like, when is this war that they're leading up to going to happen? Because they can hear both the military exercises that are taking part, but they're not informed about it at all. Some of the military bases are out in airports. Some of the military bases are also just out in the countryside. And a lot of them are on the coast. And a lot of the fisher folk who live there have been pushed out in order to make these facilities for American soldiers. And one of the groups that I was in a part of was actually able to go in and inspect the American bases. And what they saw them do was play soccer. They saw them just lollygagging around. But for the people, that's actual fear for them, as they don't know what's coming next. So just seeing a society that was influenced by American rule so early in its stages and the way it still manifests itself, one, in the form of culture, and like the people speak English over there because, but also seeing the fact that Manila is a different city as it used to be, and it was also very influenced by America, but also seeing the view of like the everyday people on America as being this great entity that's going to save them, but also seeing the organizers who are on the ground trying to change that, and see that the Philippines being the biggest exporter of human labor to other countries is not something that they should think is a great opportunity provided, but really points to the conditions of which the Filipino people are forced to live under and need to change.
Yeah, my time in Guatemala, I feel like I got to see a few different ways that militarism manifests. Principally, I went to observe the trial, and the precedent of the trial is that a genocide happened, mainly in the 80s, but really 70s up until 2000s, some would say. And so the effects of militarism, I don't think it's a stretch to say, like, me sitting here is a product of U.S. militarism, right? Before the start of the armed conflict that led into the genocide, it was the U.S. government pushing for the overthrow of a democratically elected president for the sake of the United Fruit Company. I hope all the Dulleses are suffering currently in the afterlife. Right, but now it really, I think it's also important to name, like, how do they continue to how does it continue to manifest now? One is that even as the trial is ongoing, there's still so many efforts by the defense to use any and every tactic to delay the trial. This trial was started in the early 2000s, or like the ball started rolling. Now we're in 2024. And it was supposed to end in April, then in July, and it's still going until now. Some other ways that it happens is while I was there, many people were like, Guatemala isn't a country. It's a finca. Finca can mean property, ranch, estate. But typically when I translate it, I say Guatemala is a plantation. I think Ruby made a point around the land, and I think it always goes back to the land and the fact that people struggle to survive, you know, food security, homelessness, and this is a direct product of that. During the part of the plans of the genocide was scorched earth tactics, forcing entire communities to go live in the mountains, and then there's plenty of resources there. One, farmland, but two, silver, gold. Another product of it is that there are thousands of people who were adopted or kidnapped from their families, most of them ending up in the United States, but throughout Europe and in Canada as well. You know, and these are people I would meet. I had the privilege of staying at the home of someone who was adopted to Canada. I remember walking in and all his posters were in French, and I was really confused. But it just, over time, I began to realize how I had never really heard of this before, right? Like the mass forced adoption of so many children to across the globe. Going back to the food security piece, while I was there, there was a lot of talk, you know, like amongst my family too, of the canasta básica, which means the basic basket. So it was essentially a way to gauge how much essential foods cost. And it had like doubled or tripled in price. like my grandma was like, you know what, I'm not cooking with tomatoes this week because like they're really expensive. And so the effects really impact every single person there. And I think that really became clear. Another effect was just like political assassinations are still happening. Imprisonment, political imprisonment is still happening. I think last week, someone from Codeca, which is like a peasant, mainly indigenous organization, they had a member, a leader, be assassinated. So this is an ongoing thing as well. So I feel like the effects, I could be here forever, right? But those are some of the ones that really stand out to me.
Thank you. Thank y'all so much. And we will have like a Q&A at the end. So as y'all are thinking of questions, jot them down on your notebooks and your notes app. We're going to give everyone a chance to ask questions. And I think for me, being in Cuba with Christian, one of the main impacts of militarism I saw was just like, it was just so vindictive. Like the way that the U.S. views Cuba, views Guatemala, views the Philippines, like it was just, it's this weird sense of like punishing people who dare to live a world where the U.S. isn't at the center of it. It's like you're being forced to have to consider every day capitalism, even if you're in a socialist country, because the things that you need to trade with people, the syringes you need, are being withheld from you because of global capitalism and militarism. And so something that in Cuba was really, I don't know, really shocking to me was like, girl, they're punishing Canada. If Canada wanted to trade with Cuba, they'll get sanctioned from the U.S. If any other, if most countries, right, wanted to trade with Cuba directly, they're paying some sort of like tax on top of that, because the U.S. wants the Cuban people to suffer. They want them to suffer for not believing in capitalism and for successfully revolting against a U.S.-backed dictator, right? The Cuban Revolution was overthrowing the puppet regime of Batista in the 40s. Yeah, from or up until the 40s when the revolution was later. But yeah, bro, it's just when I think of like the architects of empire, when I think of the depth of the systems that are so invested in U.S. militarism outside of the U.S., like, it's important for us to do delegations like these because, one, we're forced to see how living in all of our empire privilege, right? We're in the heart of empire. There, we do have a privilege to that, right? We have our U.S. passports. We can bop around and go on these delegations, go to other places that the people in our actual, in the actual places we went to the delegations to cannot. You have to be stolen. You have to be displaced in order to have the liberty to travel elsewhere, right? And so that kind of leads us into our second question, which is like, what were some of the ways that folks on your delegation were combating U.S. militarism because they're being forced to find a way where there is no way? And what lessons did you take from people's resilience? Okay, let's start with Ruby. Okay.
So I actually forgot to mention this at the beginning, but one of the biggest ways that the U.S. has manifested itself in the Philippines is through the concept of red tagging. So any organizer that goes to the Philippines, or people who just organize their communities, are labeled as communists and heavily harassed in the Philippines, to the point where there's big banners outside of where they live that have their picture and say that they're friends of the communists of the Philippines. But also there's been forced disappearances and forced killings and extrajudicial killings that have impacted so many organizers there. So actually one of the biggest things that they do too, you mitigate the effects of U.S. militarism is to bring these delegation trips, and that's only made possible by the organizers who are on the ground. There's no way we would have been able to go into the Philippines and actually learn about the people who are being impacted without having these strong connections. But also in the Philippines, the organizing is very interconnected, even though it's multi-sectoral. They have the women's sector, LGBTQ sector, jeepney workers sector, and because they're able to see their struggle being replicated in different sectors and see that it's all connected, they're able to organize more closely with one another. And These organizations, they don't only exist to just organize folks, but they also exist to provide services to people. So Gabriela, which is the women's organization in the Philippines, they're most famously known for having their domestic abuse hotline up 24/7, since in the Philippines, it's not legal to get divorced. So that's one of the ways that they're helping the community. They're also known for having a help desk outside of their offices in order to have someone who's trained to respond to their needs, but also to hear out their issues. And through those ways, they're able to build services that are not offered beyond in the government. Bajag Hari is also a really good example of this. They're actually an LGBTQ organization, and they're pushing forward a SOGI bill, which is an anti-discrimination bill in the Philippines. So they also take up the legal struggle. But among that, they also organize call center-based workers, because at the very root of many of these mass organizations that we met, their main question they want to answer is, what is the struggle of our everyday people? What's the everyday struggle of a woman in the Philippines? What's the everyday struggle of a worker in the Philippines? And it's that they don't have anything to eat, or they have insecurity in their jobs. So that's really what's at the root of what they're doing. And because of that, they've been able to build out programs to feed people, to provide people with different legal services if they need. And that's just through organizing. Like, the regime, the Marcos and Duterte regime, really wishes to take away organizers and to kind of eliminate them all. But because people see these killings and tensions brought to it, it makes the people's organizing stronger, as they feel that they have a duty to fulfill, and that it's not only them, but multiple people who are doing it. And they also believe in a united front, which is to basically mass line everybody in, no matter where they're at, because that can often happen sometimes, especially here. If you don't see someone being where you're at politically, you just kind of give up on organizing them. But over there, they truly do believe that everyone has their own say in it. We actually met with a pastor who is kind of against the National Democratic Movement, but he does believe that his workers who come to him on Sunday only deserve a chance at having a life where they can feed their families and don't have to work more than 40-hour weeks. So yeah, that's what I really took from the Philippines, and just creative ways to be able to meet people, whether it be at church, at work, or even at the park, and really making sure to build a relationship before making any ask of them.
I think an interesting thing about the Cuban case is that, like, Cuba literally can't make the United States, like, end the blockade. That's, like, the responsibility of us and the Belly of the Beast and our movements here. So my understanding of what I saw in Cuba was that, like, their, like, approach to militarism is, like, building up, like, things that, like, build up for, like, long-term resiliency. So, like, the first bucket of that, like, interpret is, like, survival programs. Like, the first day we were there, like, one of the things that we, like, talked about is that there's a growing, like, homeless population in Cuba, which we were told is, like, a more, like, recent phenomenon within the, like, history of a country post-revolution. So we went to this place. I forgot what it was. Do you remember what the place was called, Peyton?
No, don't do that to me.
Okay. So it was this place where the, like, homeless population in Cuba is largely, like, elderly folks as well. So it was, like, this big center or whatever that provides, like, free housing to the elderly. And also, it's, like, it's sort of, like, a self-sufficient, like, it's sort of self-sufficient or whatever. So they have this, like, big farm on the land too, and, like, everything that they eat there and consume there is, like, things that they grow on their own. We actually got, first day we were there, we got to take part in that. Like, it's, like, very first thing we did was, like, drive out there to participate in, like, manual labor. My group got the short end of a stick. Other folks were, like, picking corn, planting flowers. We, like, got walked out past this field, and they pulled out a bunch of machetes and, like, all right, y'all, we're about to cut the grass. And I'm like, huh? But so, like, there's things, like, a lot of things like that are, like, being encouraged, like, very heavy, like, emphasis on agriculture. And we were told that this is, like, a history that goes back to, like, under the times of Fidel. Fidel would, like, call for these, like, national, like, days of, like, voluntary labor, and would be like, we must, on Sunday, every Sunday, and, like, during the Vietnam War, it would be like, we must work like they do in Vietnam, we must fight like they fight in Vietnam. And then by the time we were there, like, this is a tradition that's continued, and now we're like, we must work like they work in Palestine, we must fight like they fight in Palestine, which I think gets to the second bucket of what I'm thinking about, which is, like, acts of solidarity. I think the Cuban people, the Cuban government, they see, like, solidarity as, like, a political political responsibility as a political mandate. That's why they send these like delegations of doctors throughout the world, or because they see that as a socialist country, as a socialist project. I think somebody on one of the panels earlier in the week was like, we can't have socialism in one country. I think that's like very much like that influences way Cuba sees itself, sees its role in the world. And then that also speaks to like the importance of like the delegations that they have. Like we like this delegation is like one way that they like see themselves as like combating like US militarism and being able to bring people from across the world to just like see what we're struggling with, see what's going on. But then also just like through this like tremendous like outpouring of of hospitality, even amidst those conditions, and like just the like very bare minimum simple ask of like tell people what you saw here. While we were there, like Manolo from the People's Forum, like he was like he like told us like every single day that you are here, you will hear from somebody that you are a friend of a Cuban people, but none of us have like earned that title yet because we haven't done shit, frankly. And that was, I think that was like very very much important, and like speaks to the importance of this like of the brigades, because it's like lights a fire under you, like reminds you of your political responsibility and like reminds you of like what is to be done. I think Hanif Abdurraqib did a craft talk here like last night, and he was talking about June Jordan and this idea of self-indictment and like how that's like a basis for rage and like a basis to like just light a fire under you and like be like, okay, what the fuck am I gonna do? And I feel like that was like, I don't think that's necessarily what they intended, but like that was the impact it had on me. I think the impact it has on like other people on the brigades is like, okay, like we're seeing what's happening, so what the fuck are we gonna do or whatever? Just like building up that like tradition and orientation towards solidarity, like radical solidarity, and like how, like, not just okay, me being here is one thing, me like telling people what I saw here, that's like one thing, but that's not going to cut it. What the fuck else am I going to do? That's something that I'm still sitting with. And then like the last, I don't know if I how much time I have left, but the last bucket of what I want to talk about was like education, because people leaving Cuba or whatever, like people in Cuba that are being disillusioned, like a large portion of it is like the youth, because like I think like now like 80% of people in Cuba like were born under the blockade. Like most people like didn't see like pre-revolution or whatever. There's sort of like disconnect there. So amongst various organizations that we like spoke to, like a major emphasis was on like just popular education. Like how can we include people in the political process? How can we be transparent with people about the problems that are happening and like make them feel like they have like a part of the socialist project, but they're part of this resistance, but they're part of this fight. Even like in just an attempt to fight against disillusionment. And like one way which we saw this was like when we went to Senate 6, we were talking about the family code. Family code was like a policy just explaining, okay, like how does the Cuban government see the role of families? Discussed everything from like raising children to sexuality, trans healthcare, and like a bunch of different things. And an interesting thing was like they went through like I think like 15 different drafts of that policy before we voted on it, because they had like various periods of just public input, like if you know the like little like stands where you can like get the newspaper or whatever, you went to that one day, you had a copy of the family code there, so you could read it, think about it, and like say like, okay, how do I feel about this? Like how do I feel? And just, which I think is like a level of political participation that we just like Americans, like we don't get that. I wish we had that, and I feel like that's important, because to create this culture of resiliency and revolutionary responsibility, folks have to feel like included. Folks have to feel like they have agency over their lives, and folks have to feel like that their struggles aren't like, it's not aimless, it's not in vain, but it's for something. This shit is important. Maintaining this shit is important. So I feel like all of those things like have a role in that.
And something I'll add to what Christian said, because we're talking about how are people who are forced to combat the effects of global militarism. Ruby talked about Gabriela, the organization that supports women. Christian mentioned CENESEX, which is the National Sex Education Center in Cuba. But also, like, girl, like, in Cuba, they were still producing stuff. Like, we got to be clear. This was not no, like, destitute place where ain't nothing was happening. Cuba is a very vibrant, like, bustling, like, we were in Havana. But, like, everyone there was, like, chilling. Like, everyone there was very happy and joyful and, like, welcoming and kind despite the horrible the horrible effect of the blockade. Like, they still had, they were producing their own brands of everything. They had their own chocolate. They were still getting, they were still able to get imports from, like, other Latin American countries and, like, other countries that are in solidarity in Cuba. Russia supports Cuba a lot. Let's talk about that. We don't want to talk about that. But also, like, when, to Christian's note on solidarity, the International People's Assembly and the MLK Center, who hosted us on the brigade, just sent 800 tons of flour to Cuba, right? That took months and months and months of fundraising, because one, like, cargo ship of fuel to Cuba will last them 1 week, so 7 days, and cost $10,000. Hey, that's too much money. So imagine when you need a third of an entire, like, shipping container worth of fuel to just do basic trade and basic export. You can, because you have an entire island of people. You have public transportation, like the bus system. We need to use that fuel to, like, get power. And so that's why there's a lot of blackouts and things like that. And so despite all of that, the Cuban people, because they have such a trust in each other, to what Christian was saying, they have such a basic understanding of how they need to work together to uphold this socialist project to ensure that it stays successful. They've gotten really creative about, they're like, okay, we don't need the U.S. The U.S. needs us, because we got it going on over here under socialism. Josue.
Yeah, I think, firstly, it's just, the trial is a really big deal, right? It's a big deal because, well, first, this isn't the first trial that's gone on under the context of proving a genocide happened in Guatemala. The first trial of this sort was putting Efraín Ríos Montt, who was a president, who was president during the time, on trial. And it really was the foundation of a lot of the trials that come after, because they had the onus of proving that a genocide happened, right? And to prove a genocide, you know, numbers aren't enough. It was 250,000 victims, mainly Maya. But you have to show an intent, right? An intent to displace people, to eradicate family lineages. And so it took a lot. And when the verdict came down, it was actually the first time in the history of the world that a country found itself and its own elected officials guilty for genocide and acts against humanity. You know, in the past, you know, the Nuremberg trials and all that stuff, it's been international courts. And so this was the first instance that a country itself was like, yes, this happened. And that really opens up then the field for a lot of other cases that you have this precedent of, like, yes, there was a genocide. Now, like, it's about finding other people guilty based on the actions they took. And I think paired with the trial, like, I think the trial can bring closure. It can set legal precedent for like restitution. I think, you know, hopefully in the future, it's setting the precedent for land back. But I think there's a lot left to really right those wrongs. Or, I mean, you can't really right the wrongs of a genocide, but, you know, a guilty verdict doesn't really change the material conditions of any of the victims or their descendants. And so I think that's why it was also important to, we met with many different organizations while we were there. One of them is called CODECA. They're the Committee for the Development of Farm Workers. And they have a base in every single department, so like the equivalent of states here. In every single departamento in Guatemala, they in all 22 of them, they have a base. They have people organizing them. Sometimes they have to split them up into different parts because it's too many people to, like, I don't know, like, lead or whatever, as one individual. So they even have to, like, split up different departments. And so CODECA is really organized, and they've been organizing for decades, to the point that they're now actually stepping into electoral struggles. Not this past election, but the election prior, they ran a presidential candidate for the first time. They tied for third, which like scared the shit out of the establishment to the point that they were actually barred from running this year. But it goes to show the power that they have, and like, sure, they clip the wings of this electoral project for now. And like their primary effort is to have a plurinational constitution that's, derived from a plurinational representative constitutional congress that would bring in everyone of all the different Maya. There's also like Xinka, the Garifuna, bring them all together to create this new constitution. And like, yes, the wings were clipped, at least for this election cycle, but they're planning for next one already, and they're going to try again. And that's like on top of all the local organizing that they're doing, right? And this local organizing is what actually can shift the material conditions of the poor people of Guatemala. Another thing I noticed, we met with the Guatemalan Federation of Radio Technical Schools. So it was essentially a radio network that expanded to every corner of the country. And each radio was locally run in the language of the people there, right? Maya, like, there is no Maya language. Maya is a family of languages and people, and there's like 30 official languages in Guatemala, right? And so each of these radios gave like national updates and local updates in their own language. They even used it to teach people this language, because, you know, a product of colonialism, of capitalism, is like now everyone has to know Spanish to be like a part of society in Guatemala at times. And so they were trying to push against that by like at least making sure people continue to learn their ancestral languages. And that was the function of the radio, was to connect things. They existed even during the armed conflict. Like, they would communicate kind of through code at times. But recently, you know, this radio network has been used to reconnect families. Because so many times the children that were forcefully adopted, that were kidnapped, were of indigenous families. And so these people oftentimes don't even know Spanish, right? So sometimes people don't even know Spanish here because they know English in the U.S. Maybe they go through the process of learning Spanish. Come to find out, this second tongue that you just learned actually isn't going to make it easier for you to find your family. And so people reach out to Fejer, and they're like, hey, can you put out this call? I learned that I was maybe from this region. And it really showed me how you have to be really open with the resources you have. And find new applications for them, because there's a lot of power that already exists. Like, we don't have to reinvent the wheel, or there's people that can assist you. And so I really saw an interconnectedness between, like, anarchist collectives, like, collectives that don't really have a political ideology, with, like, NGOs in different capacities, people working on the trial, people doing like women's rights work. And it's like every time I walked in somewhere, like I could be like, oh, we just met with this person, and they were like, oh, like, how are they? Which just really showed how they're willing to help each other out, right? Even if their approaches are different. I think at times they even disagree with, like, is it worthwhile to be doing what you're doing, because it's not, they don't see the effects, you know, like for the trial, like, people are like, okay, a guilty verdict didn't change anyone's, like, livelihood. But they still continue to work together. And then the final piece is, I learned, I didn't get to, like, interact with any people involved, but there's been a 7-year occupation of a roadway that leads to a silver mine. And they forcefully turn away any and all traffic having to do with the mine. Woo. To the point that the mine hasn't been functioning in those 7 years. And, you know, a part of this panel was also, like, trying to push back against this idea of American exceptionalism. I think we all understand how it manifests in large key ways of, like, you know, America is great, whatever, da-da-da. But I think a lot of it can be internalized, too. And a lot of times I often think about the fact that, like, you know, student encampments were amazing. They were great. But I feel like when some people talk about them, they're like, wow, where did this come from? Like, this was such a revolutionary, like, idea. And I think the revolutionary part of it was the practice of it. But there's actually a long history of encampments. And I think learning about this occupation that's, like, been happening for 7 years that I had never heard of, that they're all coffee cultivators that, like, sell coffee to, like, continue funding their occupation, just, like, really opened my eyes to, like, how we have to decenter, like, the U.S. And, like, there's a lot of solutions out there. You know, revolution's not going to start here in the U.S. Like, we have to look elsewhere to see what other people are doing and what is working, and then see how we can apply it here, not just sit and be like, ah, like, I need to come up with something completely new. And because we're not going to get anywhere. We're reinventing the wheel, and it's, like, 20 different types of them. So yeah, those are some of the beautiful, like, ways that people were resisting.
Thank you, Josue. And thank y'all. We're going to do one more question, so get your questions ready, and then we're going to hop into the Q&A. So in what ways were your assumptions challenged or affirmed when spending time in the country of your delegation? I'm going to go first. Y'all, Cuba is black as hell. That was my assumption. I got off that plane and I was like, what? Look, this is where we've been the whole time. I know why Asada left and went there. Cuba is black as hell. And they preserve the history, the violent history of chattel enslavement and the transatlantic slave trade. So Fidel, and correct me if I'm wrong, the first thing that man did when he got into office, he said, we need to preserve all the slave monuments, all the history of Spanish colonialism, preserve it because these people need to know what the colonizers did to us. And to a T, everything is left. We don't see that here. Our slave stuff is a wedding venue or like an elementary school, right? He was like, y'all are going to see what these people did to us. And he said that the only reason that they were able to, I say we like I'm Cuban. child, I wish. The only way that they were able to achieve revolution or to like, for there to be revolution anywhere is to center they say Afro-descendant. And I like that. I've been saying that. The only way that we can achieve real revolution and real change under socialism is if we are centering, and not just centering, primacying black people and the descendants of slavery, girl. Like, Fidel knew that. That's why they were able to organize so effectively. And that's why to this day, from elementary school up until the highest level of your PhD, they are constantly talking about what the colonizers did to us. So, period. That was my assumption that was challenged. You want to go?
Yeah, I think this isn't even tied to like this specific delegation. I had been to Guatemala before visiting family, and I feel like my first trip to Guatemala kind of was really eye-opening in that I think capitalism is a priority here. Capitalism is the driving force behind basically every single interaction we have. As individuals, right? Like, we go in and get our nails done and not say a word to the person who's doing them. We have no idea who prepared the food that we are currently eating. No matter how delicious it is, we never bother to ask. And going to Guatemala showed me that doesn't have to be the norm. Not to say that, like, capitalism doesn't manifest there or the same things don't happen. I think if you go to certain restaurants or certain parts of certain cities, like, it's very similar, right? Also, a lot of people speak English there, just like, because it's becoming very touristy, so even that practice is being like exported to the global south. But it just showed me, like, I don't know, like, I would see my family member be like, hey, can you take this to the lady down the street? It's like ground meat, and tell her, like, you want some, like, so many tortillas, right? Like, it felt so much more natural and so much more like a natural way of life to be, like, knowing who you're buying things from and, like, exchanging things and not being pressed about, like, do you have the money now? Like, I'm gonna see you, like, at church in 2 days. Like, you can give me the money then. And it just, it showed me an alternative to, like, capitalism being the, like, fundamental, like, aspect that decided how we interact with people. And I think that also goes to, like, community care, which is, I think, something that like, Christian mentioned and Ruby mentioned around people just care for each other more. Because people are more visible, and so you feel more of a responsibility. And then I think for me, one of the craziest things was I, of course, didn't go in not expecting, like, of course there's inequality, of course there's discrimination, there's anti-blackness, colorism. I think it was just really jarring for me how impactful or how different it can be based on, like, how the idea of race was developed or, like, gender roles were developed in individual places. You know, blackness here is understood very differently than blackness in Guatemala, and indigeneity here is understood here completely differently than over there. And so I think one of the assumptions that I made was that I would be able to see it a lot easier. And I realized it took some time in being there to, like, start noticing it. And it's realizing, like, okay, like, in the same way that nonprofits here often are, like, also creating manifestations of sexism and colorism and racism and, like, transphobia, homophobia, all the things, that happens over there, too, and in such different ways. I don't know, like, it was interesting because I'm just, like, this is something we, like, all struggle with, and I think it gave me an outside perspective of how you can overlook these things, right? Because you're a social justice organization, like, it could never happen, right? Or, like, you know, just because someone isn't a bigot doesn't mean they can't be, like, they can't harm people, right? And I think that my experience in Guatemala and, like, how jarring it was made me, like, kind of reflect here how we have to be a lot more intentional about pushing back against these things because, they will continue to manifest until you make the explicit effort and commitment to, like, combat it.
True. I guess misconceptions for me, I think important context is going in. Like, I was going into this experience, like, very, very just disillusioned with, like, organizing and, like, social, like, our social movements, like, more generally, because I was, like, a senior in college this past semester, which was, like, a very difficult time to be an organizer, and we, like, a lot of folks, we got our asses kicked, and we're like, damn, like, what the fuck are we doing? So I kind of went into this experience in Cuba thinking of it, like, okay, let's see what the winners are, like, thinking about. Let's see what the winners are up to. And I was, like, coming in expecting to, like, with a whole lot of questions, expecting to have a whole lot of answers. And I think I came out of that experience with even more questions or whatever. Because, like, I feel like Cuba, they won, and then just got a whole new set of, like, existential, like, political questions to deal with. And then just thinking through our, like, relationship to that, because I think we went to this place, it was called the, like, House of Friendship. We were talking to this, like, Cuban diplomat to the United States or whatever, like, yeah, Alex. And somebody, like, asked him about, like, where do they see, like, opportunity between, like, with the blockade and, like, U.S.-Cuba relations and stuff. And he was just straight up, like, regardless of who wins this election, regardless of who's in power over the next few years in the United States, we see, like, no possible change in, like, U.S. policy towards Cuba. And I just, back to the, like, okay, what the fuck are we going to do piece or whatever, I just, like, kept, like, I keep thinking about, like, I don't, what will it take to get to the point where, like, that's no longer the case? And I also thought back to, right before we left to Cuba, me and Peyton and our comrade Angel talked to another comrade, Huri, about, because he had been to Cuba before, so we were just, like, asking questions about what to expect and stuff. And he, like, looked at us and was like, I want you to go into this and just, like, understand that Cuba is just another country, and for most of the world, Cuba is just another country. And, like, coming out of that, I was like, I was coming to, like, Cuba's this very special place. They did something impossible, and, like, we're going to have all the answers, and, like, that was not the case. And then also just thinking about, how Fidel was just some dude, and Che was just some dude, and Vilna Espin was like just some dude or whatever. And we're just like, 80 people got on a boat with a handful of guns, and they like transformed an entire country. And like, to the point of them just being some people, I think we, like, one thing I came out thinking is like, okay, we need to start treating ourselves with the same seriousness that we treat the Cuban Revolution and like all these like individuals that who we idolize. And then I feel like I'm going all over the place, but then like another thing that like Alex said was that like, okay, if you're trying to build a house, don't sit and like argue about the color that you're going to paint the ceiling. And just thinking about how that relates to us and our movements, I will just say I just graduated college, so I'm sort of talking about my ass. But I also think that I feel like our social movements are sort of like, we're, some folks are trying to build a house, some folks are trying to paint the ceiling a particular color, but I think a lot of folks haven't really like thought about like laying down the foundation and realize, like thinking about like what is power and what does it take to build power? Because I feel like that's like the primary question we need to have right now, because there's so much mobilization going on, but we're still like losing in a way. And I think we need to take more seriously about like, okay, we already know what must be done, so we need to focus on like building the capacity to actually do that. And yeah, so like very like big question that I acquired instead of an answer to anything, which is still good, and I think is still clarifying and is like grounding and allows us to move in a more meaningful way.
Okay. Yeah, background. I had never been outside of the country before. I went, and I was very new to learning about the Philippines, their society and revolution going there. So I think, yeah, I kind of got whiplash going in and seeing how the U.S. can impact another country and how it shows itself very clearly for us, but for how the people in the Philippines can view it as something normal. Like, it's normal to see U.S. troops walking around. I feel like any of us, if we saw, I mean, it's happened before, but when, like, the National Guard comes to Chicago, we're like, what the fuck is going on, right? But for the people of the Philippines in some areas, it's like, yeah, like, they've been here for a while. Like, what do you mean? So just being able to know that, and also it affirmed for me how important it is to commit yourself to a movement. And yeah, we're not going to be the ones to wage a revolution in the Philippines, but it's important for us to build the awareness of the people who are over here, as well as build solidarity with the people in the Philippines and to push forward for actions that can change their material conditions. Because Malaya, that's a movement over here, organization, they're pushing for the Philippine Human Rights Act, which actually limits how much money the Philippines can give. I mean, how much money the U.S. can give to the Philippines in military aid. Because they just proposed to give another $2.5 billion to the Philippines over the next 5 years. And that does nothing to serve the Filipino people, nor their livelihoods, nor their future. And I guess another part of it was also learning from student organizing, and that we really need to build out something that is sustainable. Because I met someone who was 70 years old and still committed to the movement. They started off as a student, and they said, I grew beautiful in this movement. And I think that really moved me, seeing a full generation and a full generation of families that are committed to organizing. And it really comes to speak as to how they have a long-term vision, which is a revolution and getting a national, genuine democracy. And they have these steps that all of these organizations know that they're moving forward to at the core of it. And for the young people in the Philippines, especially the students, I think we could learn a lot from them. Because every single student who's in part of a mass organization does basic mass integration in their communities. So it would look a little bit different here. But in the Philippines, what it looks like is all of your free time is spent integrating with the urban poor communities, with the peasant communities, and to be there to be a part of them, but also to be able to know about their conditions and your standing as a student. And also, yeah, a lot of the students, I was talking to them, and they were talking about encampments, and I was at one of the schools that didn't do an encampment. They asked me why, and I said I just didn't see it as being something that would create change on campus since we were quite small. And they're like, yeah, that makes sense. And they were talking about the way that they couldn't do encampments either, but instead what they did was hold rallies, political education for folks, and how that's really important. And they told us about, yeah, like, a lot of times Americans can see themselves as so different from us, but in the same time, we're in the belly of the beast. We're still facing privatization of education, militarization of education. And those are things that we should connect on and be able to build forward. But we, it's important to also see the Filipino people as part of our struggle. And we, when we organize, we need to realize about the impacts that it has on the people across the world and not just on our own conditions right away.
Yeah, hearing Christian and Ruby talk made me think of one more thing, and it's how obvious it is that these governments, some would say puppet governments, you know, that was a point of contention in Guatemala while I was there, in terms of the new president, was how much were they like a U.S. like puppet. But I realized it's, when you start looking, it's so obvious that they're using the exact same playbook. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. I feel like, well, also to agree with Christian, I feel like I went in looking, like, with so many questions I was ready to answer, find answers to, and then I just left with more questions. But then, yeah, it's the same playbook. It's so obvious, you know, stalling out court cases that might actually have a meaningful impact on people's lives, creating whole narratives that delegitimize social movements. Codeca, who I mentioned earlier, they're always labeled as like the electricity thieves because they choose to tap into electricity lines as a form of resistance because they struggle to have food on the table, right? But they paint the picture of like they're all electricity thieves who raise electricity prices for everyone else in the country. You know, the government makes these like national days or these proclamations that really mean nothing. While I was there, I was lucky enough to go to like an action of, it wasn't really a protest, but it was because the president was officially recognizing all the forced adoptions that the government had played a role in facilitating, and the president was like, yes, this happened, and they had some victim like come and talk, and but there was no commitment, right? Like the president was like, we'll do everything to right this wrong, and but like I was talking to the people who were inside the presidential palace like later that night, and they were like, he didn't have a single thing in terms of like how they would actually actualize that. And it was just so crazy because I was like, okay, this is the exact same playbook. Like these tactics are tried and true and they continue to work. And so they're going to continue to use them. Yeah, so I think that was like another thing that came to mind. Yeah, that looking back, it was just so obvious.
I think that's such an important way to close out our section before we go into Q&A is that the layered network of global militarism, they're so confident that their system can, will, and has been working for them that our mandate is to get creative about how we're going to combat it. And the way that we will get creative is by looking to our comrades in other places who are directly experiencing the impacts of global militarism and asking them, and like maybe just listening instead of trying to like assert our American exceptionalism into the way that they organize. Cuba did it. I have nothing for them but ears to listen. And I hope that y'all can take that away. Let's move into the Q&A. Thank y'all so much.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.